Good afternoon, and welcome to week 16 of what looks like it should have been team total, God willing, on Megillat Esther. It's possible that we'll have something held over after next week that we'll do as a follow-up on Purim, and we'll just, you know, we'll call it Shushan Purim, sort of, Shushan Purim Plus. We'll see how far we get this week, we'll see how far we get next week. But remember, Megillat Esther is part of Tanakh. It can be learned anytime. It doesn't have to be the run-up to Purim. I want to thank Dana and Ilan Rubinstein for dedicating this series, as well as Zina Zobin for dedicating this shir for the yahrzeit of her grandfather Yitzhak Tzvi Ben Yechiel HaKohen, which was on which is on the 4th of Adar, and as well as in memory of her father-in-law Tzvi Hirsch Ben David Zichrono Levracha, whose Megillah reading was the best we ever heard. So the Shamos, both of them, should benefit from our learning. I wanted to talk about two issues in Perek Chet, in Chapter 8, and then if there's time, we'll also start on a topic from Perek Tet, from Chapter 9. Last week we started this Perek by talking about Ahasuerus's statement that he cannot rescind the decree, and we talked about whether that's just Ahasuerus being stubborn, or whether there actually was such a rule in the empire. We tried to draw evidence from Ezra as well as from Daniel on that point. And our opening discussion today is about Purim costumes, and whether today's Purim costumes are a function in any way of Mordechai's parade at the end of Perek Chet of Chapter 8. So if you take a look on the source sheet that I sent out, at the top, I bring you from Rabbi Clonimus ben Clonimus, a sefer called Evan Bochan, end of the 13th century, beginning of the 14th century in France. He said the following. He's describing their Purim practices. He says, "And on the 14th of Adar, for the sake of honor and beauty, young men are glorified and exalted, acting in a manner of insanity and foolishness." And the irony is intentional there. I didn't bring the original Hebrew because I originally translated this for a shiur years ago, for which I didn't need the Hebrew for the group that was there, and I never bothered to go back to it and retype it in the source. One, he describes now what this insanity and foolishness is. He says, "One wears a woman's dress and a necklace about his throat and acts like one of the fools with a drum and a dance and joy. Quite the celebration, including, apparently, costumes, people dressing up." I'm going to come back to the fact that it's a man wearing a dress in a little bit. It's not going to be our focus today. This is not a halachic discussion. It's a Tanakh discussion. But yes, duly noted. It gets mentioned in other texts of that time going forward. Rav Moshe HaKohen mentions it for Purim, interestingly, as well as for Hanukkah and for weddings in 14th century Germany. So this, you know, it's not only now that people have all sorts of get-ups during the dancing at a wedding, but they were doing this in Germany centuries ago. The fact that it's done to increase joy has allowed the overriding of certain halachic considerations over time. So one example of it is what we just read. You have the man wearing the woman's dress, which on the face of it seems to violate a biblical prohibition. There's also the practice that some have of wearing shatnez. Not shatnez biblically, but shatnez rabbinically. Meaning, the law of shatnez says you're not allowed to wear what? Sorry?
Not the linen.
Wool and linen. Combinations of wool and linen. However, strictly speaking, the prohibition against wearing wool and linen refers to wool and linen that are combined in the same thread. There's a lot of discussion about that. The word shatnez being understood in the Gemara as shua, tevi, venoz, having to do with the threads actually being spun together. It's not straightforward, but basically it's hard to violate shatnez biblically. Generally speaking, if someone is going to be wearing shatnez, wool and linen, it's going to be that which is prohibited rabbinically. And historically, this was permitted for the sake of Purim costumes. So that's one point. And then you have again the man wearing the dress as a second point. If you take a look on your sheet, you'll see in source number 2, I gave you a link for a shiur of mine where I discussed Purim costumes in greater depth and gave you some halachic material as well. So you could always go there if you want to know more about that. But I do want to come back to the Shatnez point, because that one is just fascinating to me. And it's going to be relevant to where we're going with this shiur. So you tell me, what is the connection between costumes and Purim? Why should costumes be worn on Purim? How do they fit? I have a whole bunch of explanations. I have like 9. So, you know, if you can give me more, that'll be even better. Why should costumes be appropriate for Purim?
I haven't read your source sheet, but I would say there's a lot of hiding, pretending, acting, you know, so that is very much part of the story. And one can argue part of what saved the Jewish people.
Right.
So it would be appropriate.
Right. So there's a lot of disguising going on in the Megillah. And I want to highlight 2 aspects of it, one of which is clothing-based and one of which is not. Esther, in particular, has a disguise theme, and particularly in terms of clothing. Obviously hiding her identity in the beginning, not telling anybody of her nationality. Then taking on the special clothing and the cosmetics that are emphasized before she goes to Ahasuerus, 6 months in this, 6 months in that. And then when Mordechai shows up and Esther, you know, he's wearing sackcloth, and Esther, you know, demands that he change his clothes, and dressing up in Malchut for Ahasuerus. So you have Esther dressing up as part of the story, sometimes literally and sometimes figuratively. And that's one dimension of this. Another dimension of it is stressed by Rabbi Yitzchak Weiss regarding a disguise that's not clothing-based. Take a look at source number 3. Rabbi Yitzchak Weiss, this is not Rabbi Yitzchak Weiss, who people may be familiar with, who wrote the Menchas Yitzchak. He was a Dayan in England and then in Israel. This is an earlier Rabbi Weiss. He was killed in the Shoah. And he says it's about Haman hiding his hatred for the Jewish people when he approached Ahasuerus. He says, if you see number 3 here, Betam Levishat Partzufin Bepurim, regarding why people wear costumes on Purim, Esav hid his enmity for Yaakov, and Haman hides it before Ahasuerus. And therefore, too, he says on the flip side, Eliyahu came to the king disguised as Charvona, and caused Haman to be hanged. The Medrash we talked about last week, that Charvona comes into his special knowledge because he's actually Eliyahu. So there you have the disguise on the positive side. So that's another way that disguising shows up in the story. You could also add, the whole story involves so much clothing, right? Think about it. You start with the emphasis on the clothing and the materials, the fabrics in Ahasuerus' party. You continue with Vashti and the whole idea of being brought before the king in the crown and not in anything else as the Medrash reads it. You have Esther's pageant. You have Mordechai's clothing of mourning. Esther's dressing up as royalty for the king. Mordechai's parade. Haman, who has to get dressed before each party. They emphasize that. The agents of the king have to come dress him up. And then Mordechai, again, coming before the king in royal clothing. There's a lot of clothing, a lot of changes of clothing in general in the Megillah. What else would you say leads us to have costumes for Purim? Yes, Janine.
I suppose you could say that it looks like the whole story took place by natural means, but it was really Hashem hidden.
Right.
Right.
So you could move to themes. In other words, we've been talking about reasons within the story, but the theme of it, Hashem operating, so to speak, from behind a mask, you know, is part of this. Remember when we started talking about Megillat Esther in the beginning of the year, we talked about the opposition between Esther and Shoftim. How in Shoftim, we are told God is running the show, and this enemy comes because God brought them, and this time the enemy is driven back because God performs a miracle. Everything is miracle in Shoftim, and here in Esther, it's the flip side. Even if there's something that God is doing, we're going to be told about it in terms of a natural pattern of events, God operating from behind a mask. And that's an explanation. Yes, Susan, and then Rebecca.
I think that one of the reasons for costumes is Igadata Levincha, to tell children about participating in the story and what the story is about at their level.
So Susan points out that you want to bring children into it. The costumes are a great way to do it. I would note that historically, the costumes were actually worn by adults. In our day, it's become a child's thing. Like many of the best practices have ended up somehow with children. I wrote an article a few years ago for the YU Torah to go for Sukkot about what a shame it is that people have turned Sukkot decorating into a children's activity. Instead of it being for adults. The same thing is true here. The costumes are supposed to be the adults, but you're right. It does allow for and encourage a cross-generational type of celebration, which hopefully, along with Banging for Haman, will help the children to get drawn into it. The Banging for Haman is another one that has some controversy in terms of the children. That's its own discussion. Rebecca.
Well, I was going to just say the Nafohu. We say that things get flipped over. So you see, even in the sources, talking about dressing up. I mean, men dress up as women, really? I mean, because we know of the prohibitions of wearing the clothes of a man versus and a man wearing the clothes of a woman. So it's very much in the theme of things being flipped.
Right.
Dressing.
Correct. So that's actually there's a sociologist by the name of Jeffrey Rubinstein, who wrote an article called Purim, Liminality and Communitas, in which he talks about Purim as sort of a liminal festival, marking a rite of passage by erasing identity as part of preparation for what comes next. In this case, the image of an Olam Haba, redemption, that comes next. So you erase identity first in order to be able to transition into something new. So you have that, you definitely have that as well. One of my kids learned in school at some point, going back to the story roots for costumes, one of my kids learned in school at some point that it was so that Haman wouldn't know who was Jewish. I thought that was a very interesting idea. I have no idea where that comes from. That was a very interesting idea.
It wasn't then.
Yes.
I mean, it's almost the teacher taking that, we have that idea in other areas of Judaism, right? And it sort of doesn't really make sense.
Yeah, and like I said, I don't know where it comes from, but yeah, Paul makes a note in the chat about Mardi Gras and other festivals, so that's something that Rubinstein builds on in his article, is festivals in different cultures which involve a breaking of rules for a period of time, in order to come back to the rules in a stronger way afterwards. And of course, you take Mardi Gras as an example, a festival that then is going to lead into Lent. So you do have that idea there. I see Moish has his hand up. So Moish, are you going to give us a costume explanation? I can't hear you.
I'm just going to follow up on the lady who said Igadata Levincha.
Yeah.
She's a genius. Because costume changes by the generation. We're not going to be wearing the costumes they wore in Shushan or they wore in Germany in the 14th century. The kids are going to put on whatever they're wearing these days, which I have no idea what it is, but they do, you know what it is, SpongeBob pants or whatever.
These days it's masks.
Sorry?
These days it's masks.
I'm sorry?
Never mind.
Yeah, right. That's right. Of course, but in other words, it's current. It's what they make it to be.
Yes, it's true. They're definitely true. I want to throw in two more ideas that are theme based. The Maram Chagiz, in his work Ela HaMitzvot, points you to a Gemara, which I brought you in source number 4. Where the Gemara talks about how the Jews went to Achashverosh's party. This is within that idea which we've talked about, that the party celebrates the captivity of the Jews. And that the Jews are specifically punished for participating in the party of Achashverosh. So Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai says to his students, the Jews may have only participated for show because they didn't want Achashverosh to hate them, so that's why they went to the party. Sorry, so Hashem also only threatened them for show. Hashem never planned to have them destroyed. The idea that this whole thing is an act is echoed in the Purim costumes. So that's another possibility. And then one more idea from the Upta Rav, also known as the Ohev Yisrael, Rav Avram Yoshua Heschel in source number 5. He makes the point that there's great joy in absurdity and in having the opposite of what one expected. When one changes the clothing that is normally suited for his status, I'm just reading my English translation because there's a lot of text here. When one changes the clothing that is normally suited for his status, and he wears other clothes, which he doesn't usually wear, this causes laughter and gaiety for all who see him. It is as we see on Purim, when a Jewish man changes his clothes and wears the garb of a woman or an idolater, it causes joy and gaiety. Whereas when we see a woman or idolater in those same garments all year long, there is no joy. Right? When you expect to see someone wearing that clothing, it doesn't inspire joy. It's because it's unexpected. In truth, the essence of joy is due to a reversal. And so the great miracle of Purim and the joy came via, it was reversed, v'nafochu, as Rebecca said before, and the Jews would reign, and so on. So that reversal theme becomes very important. But now I want to show you the connection to chapter 8. Because while some of the theories we've mentioned do include the clothing that Mordechai wears, the Rabbi Akiva Mails, who is a friend of mine for quite a few years now, wrote an article in Tradition in which he offered a very, very interesting theory. And I gave you in source number 9 on the sheet the title and link to the full article, so you can follow up online, because I'm not presenting his whole point. But I think it's spot on. Take a look at source number 6, please. Rabbi Moshe Isserles writes the following. He quotes the Maharil, an early Ashkenaz authority, saying that some people wear Shabbos and Yom Tov clothing on Purim. In other words, it is a Yom Tov. But beyond the fact that Purim is a Yom Tov, Rav Yaakov Chaim Sofer, the Ka'af HaChaim, writing in a Sephardi code of law, says, of course you're going to wear Shabbos and Yom Tov clothing. How could you not wear Shabbos in Yom Tov clothing? He says, source number 7, V'yobash bigda Yom Tov mi ba'erev. One should wear Yom Tov garb from the evening. V'lo ka'osen shenoagin lobosh ba'boker Yom Purim. Unlike those who just get dressed up in Shabbos in Yom Tov clothing on Purim morning. How? Why? V'hu zecher v'atilbash Esther malchut. Because the pasuk says, Esther wore royalty. U'mordechai yatsa, right, in chapter 8, Bilavush Malchut, and Mordechai went out before the king and so on in royal garb. How in the world can you read those psukim in the Megillah wearing weekday clothing? This is also found in Eliyahu Rabbah, another halachic work. So what he's suggesting is that the reason to dress in a particular way on Purim, in his case, Shabbos and Yom Tov clothing, is in order to reflect the way Esther and Mordechai dress at the height of the Megillah. Okay, you follow? So this is not costume right now. It doesn't sound like costume right now. This is, you're reading about Esther and Mordechai dressing up in fancy clothing, and that's their victory, so too you should. But isn't that exactly the point? It's a costume. You are dressing up as Esther and Mordechai. And in light of that approach, I refer you back now to chapter 8, sentence 15 in the Megillah. Look at what Mordechai wore. Mordechai went out from before the king, Yatzam lifnei melech, bilavush malchut, in royal garb, tchelet. What is tchelet? Blue? Whatever that color is, yeah, but it's not a color. It's a thing. It's blue what?
It's a piece of
Wool. Tchelet.
Are you saying you think it's a tzitzit?
No, not necessarily tzitzit. I mean, I would like to think he's wearing tzitzit, but it's tchelet, fundamentally, is blue wool. Whenever you see the word tchelet used in the Chumash, it talks about it over and over again, it's wool that is dyed tchelet. Then you have chur, okay? I'm going to ignore chur, because it's not relevant for us right now. The ateret zahav gidola, a great big gold crown, v'tachrich butz v'argaman. Tachrich, don't think tachrichen, shrouds. The tachrich means a garment of butz v'argaman. So what is argaman? They just had that big archaeological find last month with argaman, right? They found from the time of David and Shlomo. The argaman is a wool that is dyed royal purple. And what is boots? Those who have learned Mishnayos Yuma know.
Linen.
Linen. It's white linen. So Mordechai is wearing tcheles, argaman, which are wool. And he's also wearing boots, which is linen.
He's wearing
shatnez. So Rabbi Moshe Isserles, the Ramah, in his commentary to Megillas Esther, called Mechir Yayin, in the introduction to it, says that the, yes, he's wearing tachrich butz v'argaman, but it's layers. So it's, in other words, it's not wool and linen together. It's a layer of wool. It's a layer of linen, which will reduce it. Now we're not talking biblical shatnez, which is good. If you take a look at source number 8, I brought you from the Chayei Adam. It's his Chochmas Adam regarding wool and linen. And he says, there is a common practice of joining wool and linen garments with a layer of silk or leather separating them. Rambam considers this biblically prohibited shatnez. He doesn't like it. But girding with a belt, when one side is linen, the other side is wool, then even if there is a strip of leather in between, still, since he ties the two ends together when he wears it, all agreed is at least rabbinically prohibited. I'm not going into the ins and outs and details of shatnez. My point is that if you have two layers with something beneath them, like the strip of leather here, if you tie it together, it's still usher prohibited at least rabbinically. And the point is this. If you want to know why people would be wearing rabbinically prohibited shatnez, such that we need to say, don't worry about it, you're allowed to wear shatnez in your Purim costume, it's not because they went to the costume store and all the costumes that they had on the rack had wool and linen in them. Right? I mean, ask yourself. I can understand why you have a question of, is a man allowed to wear a women's garment for Purim? Because that's a costume that he might say, I'd like to wear that. That looks funny, or that looks cool, or that resembles Esther, or whatever. I can understand that. I can't understand somebody saying, what I really want this year is to dress up in shatnez. Please, could I dress... Rabbi, here's my question for you, Rabbi. Am I allowed to wear shatnez in my Purim costume? You look at him and say, what, out of your mind? But it's not that. It's not incidental. The shatnez is the costume, because you're trying to dress up like Mordechai. Just like the idea in the Ramah and the Kaf HaChayim in sources 6 and 7 that said, wear Shabbos clothing, wear Yom Tov clothing, to dress up like Mordechai and Esther. So people wanted to wear costumes with some form of shatnez in them in order to resemble Mordechai and Esther. And like I said, see the article for more on this. The article is in source number 9. But that would mean that the Purim costume, you want to know why we have a Purim costume? It's part of dressing up as Mordechai and Esther do in their roles in the Megillah. Follow? Okay. Which brings me to chapter 8, sentence 17. And yes, as we've said for every other chapter in the Megillah, there is so much going on here that we don't have time to cover. Paul asks me in the chat, why did Mordechai wear shatnez? Right? Just pushes the question back to Mordechai. And I think the answer is, these are the garments that they hand him. These are the royal garments. And so since it's shatnez rabbinically, we do have a precedent for permitting certain things in order to be close with the government. The Gemara talks about Rabban Gamliel's household cutting their hair in a way that was specifically the practice of the aristocracy in Rome in order to be able to traffic in government and be of influence there. So it could be, is it Rabbi Gamliel or the Reish Galusa? It might have been the Reish Galusa, the exilarch. It might not be Rabbi Gamliel. But the point is the same. I think that would be why Mordechai did it. It's also unclear, keep in mind, whether what we're saying is that what Mordechai wore was rabbinically prohibited and yet allowed for him, or whether what Mordechai wore was completely separate, and it's just that the costumes became a way to highlight this and people wore it in a closer way. That's unclear to me. Go back to the Mail's article for more on that. But Pasuk Yud Zayin, sentence 17. This is a very interesting focus for me. U'v'chol medina u'medina, in every land out of the 127. U'v'chol ir va'ir, and in every city. Mekom asher dvar hamelach v'daso magia, where the king's order reached. Simcha v'sason la'yehudim, the Jews are rejoicing. Mishte v'yom tov, there is feasting, they are celebrating. V'rabim me'amei ha'aretz misyahadim, ki nafal pachad ha'yehudim aleihem. And many from the nations of the land are mityahadim. Tell me something. Some of you are using translations. I want to know how your translations render the word mityahadim. Susan, you have the pink edition. What does mityahadim have? What
became Jews.
They became Yehudim. They became Jews. Okay. Debbie, what do you have?
Professed to be Jews.
Professed to be Jews. Is that the same thing?
No.
It's, hey, we're Jews too.
I profess to be 18 years old. I mean, I'm not, but I pretend.
You can profess whatever you like.
That's right.
There you go. Anybody have anything different in their translations? Joyce has what? Which edition do you have? Oh, you have the Koran one. You have became Jews. So like Susan's.
Yeah.
Okay. Anyone have an art scroll? I don't think we've quoted an art scroll yet.
I've gone.
Debbie's your...
Professed to favor the Jews.
Oh, professed to favor the Jews. Who? Which one is that, Toby?
It's Ellen.
Oh, Ellen. Which one is that? Profess to favor the Jews. Debbie, what were you going to say?
Yeah, you have to read it in context of the rest of the sentence.
Yeah.
It says, for the fear of the Jews had fallen upon them.
Yeah.
You can't read that phrase in an isolated way.
Oh, no, that's for sure. That's where we're going, at least in part. So, the Gemara thinks that they converted. Take a look at source number 10, the Gemara in Yevamos. The Gemara in context is not just talking about the story of Purim. It's talking about people who convert with ulterior motives. And it says, V'chein mishin is gayer l'shum shulchan melachim. If somebody converts in order to partake of a royal table, they think they'll become wealthy or they'll benefit from somebody else's wealth. L'shum avdei shlomo, they want to serve Solomon. And that comes from the beginning of Ezra and in Malachim, where we talk about the descendants of Solomon's servants. Einam geirim divar Rabbi Nechemya. So Rabbi Nechemya says, that's not a valid conversion. You wanted to be wealthy, you wanted to be in among the rich and powerful. That's not valid, says Rabbi Nechemya. Shahayir Rabbi Nechemya Omer, because Rabbi Nechemya used to say, Echad geirei arayos, whether people who convert because of fear of lions, and he's talking about whom when he says that? What does he mean by lions?
The Shamronim,
the Samaritans. We're gonna read their story in a little bit, but the Samaritans convert because of fear of lions, as well as Gerei Chalomot, people who convert because of dreams. They have a dream that frightens them, and they say they're going to convert. And ve'echad gerei Mordechai ve'Esther, as well as people who convert in the time of Mordechai and Esther. And that's talking about our passage. Einam gerim. Rabbi Nechemya says, that's not a valid conversion. So in other words, what we're seeing here is people who professed to become Jewish, but it's not legitimate according to Rabbi Nechemya. I'm not sure if the story about people who convert due to dreams is referring to a specific event in Tanakh. I wonder, because it appears between the case of the lions, which is Tanakh, and Mordechai and Esther, which is Tanakh, but I can't think of a case in Tanakh in which somebody converts to Judaism because of a dream. I don't know if anybody else here can think of anything. I mean, Nebuchadnezzar has frightening dreams and he praises God, but there's no mention of conversion in his story. Chana?
Could this be also one of the reasons for the costumes? Because people pretended, like Esau pretended to love Yaakov by fighting him, so pretend because they're afraid. So
right.
Pretending is...
Another example of disguising and pretending. Could be. I hear that. But this is all Rabbi Nehemiah. Yes, Susan.
Can I say something about my commentary?
No. No, you have to hold off. We're not there yet. I'm going in a particular order.
No,
and I am certain that what your commentary has to say, we'll get to. Just hang in there.
What you just said something.
Just wait with it, please.
Okay.
So that's Rabbi Nehemiah speaking. However, the Gemara continues. Am Rabbi Yitzchak bar Shmuel bar Marta mishmei de Rav. Rabbi Yitzchak bar Shmuel bar Marta quotes Rav. And by the way, that in and of itself is an interesting story. Shmuel bar Marta was one of the sages, as you can see here, in the early period of the Amoraim. But unlike most sages who are identified with their name and their father's name, he's mentioned with his mother's name, Marta. And there's a whole story behind that. But in any case, Rabbi Yitzchak bar Shmuel bar Marta says, quoting Rav, Halacha kedivrei haomer kulam gerim heim. The law follows the view that they are all valid converts, meaning after the fact, as the Gemara then continues to discuss. So, b'di'eved, this is a valid conversion. However, this really isn't supposed to happen, which raises a question. If it's not really supposed to happen, then how did it happen? Meaning, if you're not supposed to accept people who convert in a situation like this, then did the Beis Din not know the rules? So take a look at source number 11, which addresses this question, as well as the question of other stories that we find of people who convert at a time when they become enamored of something, something special has happened that they want to jump on the bandwagon of. And Tosfos' answer in number 11 is, Deme atzman nisgairu. They converted on their own. He's talking about a case which we're going to get to, or at least allude to, from a different Gemara in Yevamos. But he says, Kida ashkechon gabe Mordechai ve'ester v'rabim me'amei ha'aretz misyahadim. He says, as we find in the story of Mordechai and Esther, the Tosfo says, they're not doing it with a Beis Din. They accept Jewish practices. Maybe they grab three people and say, you're my Beis Din, I accept Jewish practices, I'm going to go jump in the lake now. But that's the way that Tosfos understands it. And it seems that nonetheless, after the fact, this is indeed a valid conversion. And I say that based on source number 12. I see you, Chana. I say that based on source number 12, which makes a very interesting link. Rabbi Yechiel Michal Epstein, writing at the end of the 19th century, beginning of the 20th century, says the following. He's discussing the laws of conversion. This is not a commentary on the Book of Esther. This is a commentary to the Shulchan Aruch, to the Code of Jewish Law. And he says, they converted on their own. V'nasu geirim girurim. They became geirim girurim. That's a phrase that is used in a variety of places. It means a kind of inferior sort of conversion that I translated as they are appended. They're sort of added on and they join in. Kemosha be made David Ushlomo, like in the time of David and Solomon, Nitosfu Gerim Gerurim Me'atzmam. You had such people join on their own. Ukemo, and like Shemi Mitzrayim Alu Erev Rav, Bir Osam Gedulas Yisrael, Vehem Hayul Yisrael Lamokesh. The Erev Rav, right? If you remember who the Erev Rav were, the Erev Rav is a description that's used in the Torah for a group of Egyptians who left Egypt with the Jews. I'm going to come back to them in a little bit. They saw that, you know, to use Rebecca's example earlier with Harvona, they saw who was winning And they said, we're going to join the winning team, and they left Egypt with us. And of course, they end up being a cause of stumbling for Israel, because we are taught that those are the ones who lead the creation of the golden calf. So one school of thought here, which emerges from the Gemara, follows through in Tosfos, and is accepted in various sources, is that these were people who attempted a maverick conversion to Judaism. The Jews are suddenly on the good side. Mordechai is in charge. The decree has gone forth. They're able to defend themselves. Uh-oh. Time for us to pretend that we're Jewish, so we are going to now act as though we are Jews. Now, act in terms of conversion. Ibn Ezra, on the other hand, if you take a look at source number 13, says, forget conversion. Who needs to be a convert? All you have to do is like Levi's rye bread. He says, V'yitachein, in source number 13, V'yitachein heyos misyahadim sheyisyachasu al shevet Yehuda. Ibn Ezra first has this long discussion of the grammar of the word mityahadim, and then once he concludes the grammar point, which completely confused me, but once he completes that, he says, mityahadim could mean that they claimed yichus, they claimed lineage of Yehuda. Mityahadim, Yehuda. So, according to Ibn Ezra's approach, they pretended to be Jews. That was found in somebody's commentary before, somebody's translation before, had suggested that they pretend that they are Jewish from the beginning. And then you have one other approach, Professor Amos Chacham in the Da'at Mikra, who says, no, Mitraim ke'ohavei ha-Yehudim, which someone else had in their translation. They pretended to be allies of the Jews. We love Jews. That's your other approach. So you've got three ideas here. Either we're going to be Jewish, or we've been Jewish all along. It's like Leaf fans. Either we are Leaf fans, or we were Leaf fans all along. Or they pretend to be allies of Jews. Yes, Rebecca.
Not to be disparaging of it, but many people left Russia that way.
You're right. No, it's true. When the Iron Curtain opened for Jews to be able to leave, you end up with a lot of people who either were not Jewish altogether, or you had a lot of people who were paternally Jewish and who said, you know what? I was persecuted just like everybody else. I'm a Jew too. And left that way. This is certainly true. Yes, Moish. Thank you.
Because that's exactly what I was going to use with the one before. It's not that they appeared to be allies. They were simply allies. They were allies for the moment. It's like when Frank Mahovlich plays for the Leafs, you love him. When he plays for the Canadians, you still love him.
So the thing is this. I agree with you, and actually in my own notes I had written for myself, they became allies. The problem is that as I was reading it now, Professor Chacham says, Mitraim. They made themselves appear like. He doesn't see it as sincere.
That's what I disagreed with.
Oh, okay. So you can disagree with him.
Why would you pretend to make yourself an ally? You're an ally. You can be not an ally 5 years from now.
And the answer is because if you're doing it out of convenience, you're not really an ally. I mean, that's the whole discussion in today's society of allyship surrounds this issue. But
a perfect example from our time. Look at all the lone soldiers in Israel who... I'm not going to deal with what it means not to be Jewish or to be Jewish, but who aren't Jewish.
Mm-hmm.
That's, you know...
That's genuine, Jewish. Though. That's not Mitraim. That's genuine. But I want to go further with this, though, because there's something more to be said. Yes, Susan?
You still haven't touched what this commentary...
Go for it. Okay.
This is interesting, because he said... combines both interpretations of it. Many of the people of the land attempted to convert to Judaism, but were not accepted because no proselytes were accepted in the time of Mordechai.
Yeah, that's the source in number 10. That's the Gemara. That's Rabbi Nechemya's view.
That nobody was allowed?
Correct. Rabbi Nechemya says they wouldn't have been valid. Right, What?
Was there a law that nobody...
No, it's go back to source number 10, because they're converting for the sake of gain.
Right, but it said that's not what I interpreted him to mean, so that's why.
No, that's what he means. It's because of gain. That's the issue. Yeah. The but I wanted to take this further because I think that there's a deeper point to be made here. There are really two avenues for the act of mityahadim. There are two different ways to read this. As we've said now for quite a few weeks, you can read the fall of Haman and the rise of Mordechai as a function of Mordechai's rescue of Ahasuerus in chapter 2 and Esther's plot in chapters 5 through 7, right? Natural means. In which case, mityahadim doesn't mean they were religiously impressed, because there's nothing religious about it. There's no reason to join the religion. It's just that they want to join us politically. In which case, I will take Ibn Ezra's view, they pretended to be ethnically Jewish, or I will take Dat Mikra's view, they become our allies for real, or they pretend to become our allies one way or the other. In which case, the word the Megillah uses, mityahadim, either means what was suggested already in Ibn Ezra, which is claiming to be from the tribe of Yehuda, or they're joining the people of Yehud. Remember, we said back in chapter 2, the word Yehud is the word used for Judea. As found in Sefer Ezra, as found in Sefer Daniel, the word Yehud was just a word for Israel, what we call Israel today. So that's one way that you could read this, is that mityahadim is a political statement, a reaction to political events. Or you could read that whole story as being about divine manipulation. The whole story about how Ahasuerus can't sleep, and then he has it read before him, and it turns out that it was Mordechai, right? And all the interventions of Charvona being Eliyahu, and of Haman falling on the bed, and king going out to the orchard and having them, you know, the angels telling him that Haman said to uproot the trees. It's all divine manipulation. In which case, the nations reading it that way will be religiously impressed and will say, we want to become Yehudim. We want to join the religion of Yehud. We want to join the Jews. And that's source number 10, the Gemara in Yavamo, saying that they're converting. So this can be read along either track. Either all of these events are simple political events and their attempt to join us is political, or these events are all read religiously and their attempt to join us is religion. Either way, this is the high point of the Book of Exile. Right? This is the high point of a book that's about Jews in exile. Because the book is not going to end with the Jews returning en masse to Israel. But what it has is a peak political or religious recognition, which is what happens here. Chapter 9 is cleanup. We're able to defend ourselves. We institute a holiday. And then you had chapter 10, and Ahasuerus is still in charge, and he's still levying taxes, and he's still he's still in full glory. You follow? Susan, you're shaking your head no. What's up?
I'm just a little confused, because you said this is the high point of Jews in exile.
No, I said this is the high point of this book of exile.
Oh, this book of exile. So you're saying the fact that we have this little time where we're recognized, where we want, so to speak, we're not being murdered and killed, and that's our high point.
No, I think it's people joining us either politically or religiously, depending on how you read it. That's the high point of the Jews in exile. I think that's correct.
But then
if you're looking for more, you ain't going to find it. That's why it's exile.
Okay, so it's short-term. And is this compared to anything we see it now?
What do you mean?
I mean, if I was going to take this as a lesson to learn about Jews in exile,
mm-hmm.
Are there any other time where...
So you are helping me out here. Hang on. Oh. Hang on a minute.
Okay.
Because I want to take the religious conversion idea a little bit further. I think it's part of a Tanakh-long theme. At first glance, when you first read it, it looks like this conversion idea, as the Gemara explains it, is unusual. Can you think of another account of a case in which the Jews are saved from their enemies and it leads to mass conversion?
Well, you said Mitzrayim when they left and they had all this.
So I'm going to come back to the Mitzrayim one. Any others? If you looked at source number 16, you're cheating.
But Mitzrayim was difficult, and there were other, I mean, historically we know that there were times in Europe, and I'll just talk about those, and I will ignore that source 16, where that did happen. We know that that did happen.
In Europe?
And it was somewhat positive.
That we had, when did we have in Europe a mass conversion?
Well, I don't know, I mean, in communities, I mean, I've read historically.
Really? Because I the only one that comes to mind is the Khazars and some of the potential historical precedents for that. I'm not familiar with any other. If you find something, let me know. The Maharal looks at this story and says, nah, never happened. He says, this is unique. Take a look at source number 15. He says, Davar zelo nimsa b'sha'ar ge'ulos. He says, this was never found in any other redemption. Rak bekan, only here, shunitzuach Amalek, only here because it is a victory over Amalek. Hang on one second. I just hit my computer. I hit a key on my computer by accident. There we go. Only here when you defeat Amalek, lefisha goreim Amalek, levatel achdos Hashem yisbarach. Because Amalek is the one who causes people not to recognize the unity of Hashem. And he quotes you the pasuk from the end of Ovadia, Va'alu Moshiim, right? Bahar Tzion, Lishpodes HaReisav, Aysal Hashem HaMelucha. The saviors will ascend to judge the mountain of Esav. Monarchy will belong to God. Meaning, when Esav is punished, Amalek being Esav's firstborn child. So when Amalek is punished, that's when Hashem will have monarchy. Ulekach bekan shepilu Amalek. So here, where they cast down Amalek, hayu rabim me'amei haaretz misyahadim kasher haya batel koach Haman. Then many of the people converted, taking the view of mityahadim, which I didn't want to translate here. I just left it as mityahadim, so as to avoid picking sides. Kasher haya batel koach Haman. Once the power of Haman was nullified, so he says, it's only because you defeated Amalek, this story is unique. But once we start thinking about it, we find conversion due to fear or awe of divine might in many places in Tanakh. Here are the ones that I came up with, and I'd wager there are more. I just don't know them or didn't think of them. So the first reference I gave you there, Shmot 12:38. That one I'll give you because we've already mentioned it. That's when the Torah says, "Vegam erev rav ala itam vitzon ubakar mikne kaved meod." That erev rav also came out with us. The erev rav are Egyptians who decided to join in. The next reference, Yoshua chapter 9. Anyone know who that is? The Givonim, bidyuk. Thank you. There is a tribe in Israel, a tribe of Canaanites called the Chivi, who come to the Jews and say, we are from far, far away. They come in with ragged clothing and old food and say, we came from far, far away. We're not one of those tribes you're not allowed to make a covenant with. We would like to make a deal with you. And the Jews go ahead and make a deal with them. And then find out they're Yoshevei Givon. They live in Givon. They're right nearby, and they end up accepting them, but they have to live as woodchoppers and water drawers for the Mishkan and for the Kohanim. But the point is, this is another group that is afraid because they see the early success of the Jews' battles in Israel, and then they join. I gave you another reference next, which I'm less sure about, but I'll explain what I'm talking about there. And that's a passage in Divrei HaYamim Bet, chapter 2, sentence 16. So I'll read it aloud for those who don't have a Tanakh here. Take a moment. Hope I don't need my reading glasses. Yeah, there it is. Vayispor Shlomo kol ha'anashim ha'gerim asher be'eretz Yisrael. Shlomo counted all of the gerim in the land of Israel. Achrei asfar asher sfaram David aviv, after David had counted them. Vayimatzu me'av ha'mishim elef u'shloshes alafim v'sheish me'os. There are 153,600. Vayazneim shvim elef, and it talks about what he does with these people, having them do work, essentially, giving them work to do. These are not people who had converted entirely or normally to Judaism, or they would be Jews. There would be no separating them out from everybody else. The way the Gemara in Yevamos explains it, and this is the Gemara that Tosfos was referring to back in source number 11, is when he talks about the 150,000 people who joined, is that these were people who converted. If you remember the story, when King David took care of the claim of the Givonim against the house of Shaul, the Givonim claimed that Shaul had harmed them, and David turned over 7 members of the house of Shaul to the Givonim for punishment. And when that's recognized that they carried out justice on behalf of the Givonim, that causes others to join us and convert. So maybe that should be brought as well. I'm not sure because it's not explicit in Tanakh, and I don't need it to prove the point that we have cases of others who convert. What's the one in Yonah?
Sailors.
The sailors, right? The sailors on the boat. You remember that story? The sailors on the boat who convert to Judaism I shouldn't say they convert to Judaism. They take vows and bring sacrifices to God. After that whole incident. And then I forgot one on the sheet. It's in my notes, but I just forgot to write it in. So what you want to include there is Malachim Bet, chapter 17, sentences 24 to 28. And that is the story of the Shomronim, the Samaritans. So in the case of the Samaritans, remember the story, the Assyrians conquer the 10 northern tribes, they exile the 10 northern tribes, and they move in another population. And the people they move in come in with their idolatries. And as it's recorded there in Malachim Bet in chapter 17, the idolaters who now live in the Shomron are worshiping their gods, and they get attacked by lions. That was the reference in the Gemara in source number 10. They're attacked by lions, and they don't know what to do, and they ask the priests of the Jews, and the result is that they are told that they should take on Judaism. And that's what they do. They take on Judaism while continuing to worship their idols. What's the last reference there? The one from Zechariah. I could have brought you quite a few for that.
Is it at the end of the days?
Yes. The prediction that at the end of the days, I'm just looking at what Rebecca put in the chat. Conversions occurred more frequently in the areas that were contiguous to Christian or Muslim.
Ignore it for now.
Okay. Anyway. I'll ignore it for now. They mentioned the Khazars, and they mentioned a king of Himyar as a conflict. Okay. Yeah, no, I'd like to take a look at that later. Thank you. But the prediction in Zechariah is that there will be a future battle, and the survivors of that future battle will become Jews. And we have lots of prophecies like that. Those who were with us when we learned Yeshaya, the first part of Yeshaya a couple of years ago, we had a few shiurim where we talked about whether there's an expectation in Yeshaya that the nations will become Jewish in the future. So this idea...
It's difficult when you take the future. The future is very different from the past, like looking at what might happen, I have to say. I don't think it... Anyways, okay.
No, you're right. You're 100% right, but I think that's not... The point that I'm trying to get at here is that it fits Purim into the pattern of Jewish history. In the same way that I gave a shiur at Hanukkah time about Ma'oz Tzur, and how Ma'oz Tzur only mentions Hanukkah in the fifth verse, right? If you think about Ma'oz Tzur, it talks about Egypt, right? is Egypt. It talks about Devir Kadsho Heviani, is Galut Bavel, and then Kroz Komat Barosh Bikesh is Purim, and then it mentions Hanukkah, to put Hanukkah in the pattern of Jewish history. And I feel like that's what's going on here. We emphasize Rabbim Me'amei Ha'aretz Mityahadim in order to say this is something that takes place in Jewish history with groups over time. Now, Chana notes where I was going next, which is there are cases of individuals as well, including prominent individuals who convert. Chana notes in the chat, Hilni Hamalka. I was going to note the possibly Yisro, right? Debate whether he ever converted. The Queen of Sheba, when she comes to Shlomo, and she's very impressed, although she did not convert. Another one who was very impressed was Naaman, who leaves behind Avodah Zarah, leaves behind idolatry. So we have individuals as well, both those who convert and those who don't actually formally convert. But the point is, you have this pattern in history and a Tanakh-long expectation that the nations will ultimately come to a recognition of God and of Judaism. And that's really, to me, something of significance that we're seeing here in Perek Chet with Mityahadim. So you now have a nice Dvar Torah for Purim, for the Perek Chet. The two different ways to read Mityahadim, is it about a political conversion, or is it about a religious conversion? And the idea within the religious conversion, that it's actually aligning Esther with Tanakh on the whole. So there's more to say. We're going to come back to Mishloach Manot next week. I did get an email from somebody here this week asking if I would talk about drinking on Purim. So in my weekly Beit Midrash email that I send out on Thursday mornings, I have a tradition before Purim of putting out my thoughts on it there, and that's going to go out this week as well, so you can look for it there. I'm not vague. You'll see my view about where it comes from and where it should go. I didn't mention Ruth. This is true. But Ruth is different from all of these. These are all people who convert in response to an act of God where they say God is visible, God is powerful, and so on. Ruth converts when things are bad. You know.
But when we say things like Galut Mushlim Hatsiyam, are we talking about actually converting or just a recognition?
So here you have to go back to the Yeshaya Shurim, because we did that in depth. We had that whole discussion then. I have nothing to add to what we said at that point. Chana.
What I wanted to think about Ruth, and that's also a vision of somebody who did something, one good thing, like a glon. And Ruth came out of a glon. So that's another example of where Chaborana is Zachor Latov.
Right, it's another Zachor Latov example. It's true. Chana goes back to what we were talking about before we started, and the idea of recognizing Charvona for the good that he did, even if we say that he was just an opportunist. So yes, we have this trend in Judaism, which I noted before, applies even where the agent of good didn't even know what they were doing was good. And as Chana notes, we have this idea of descendants of somebody who did one thing good being given something good as a reward for what was done originally. Eglon is one example. We have it actually with Nebuchadnezzar. Also, we have it with quite a few, but thank you. Okay, so God willing, next week we will either wrap up Megillat Esther or not, but hopefully we'll get through Perek Tet at the least. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much. It was so fascinating. Thank you.
Thank you, Rabbi. Thank you.
Thank you. Be well.